Hi, I'm Conan Tobias, the editor-in-chief and publisher of Tattle Creek. A few weeks ago, on Friday, September 9th, 2022, Tattle Creek held a little launch party, its first real in-person launch party in about 2.5 years, to celebrate the magazine's 50th issue, its 25th anniversary, and its finale. The evening featured readings by Alex Boyd, Alexander Leggett, Jessica Westhead, and Chris Chambers. And we're going to play that launch for you in just a minute. But before we do that, my opening comments got cut off, and it was really just a list of thank yous, and even though that's a really boring way to start a podcast, it's really important to me to mention some of the people and organizations who made Tattle Creek what it was. So I'm just quickly going to do a really abbreviated version of that thank you list. It'll only take a few seconds, and it'll take a lot less time than it would have if the recording hadn't gotten cut off. But very quickly, just wanted to thank the citizens, especially the taxpayers of Canada and Ontario, whose hard-earned money, which goes to the government, trickles down into organizations like the Canada Council for the Arts, the Department of Canadian Heritage, and the Ontario Arts Council, which in turn trickles some of that money down to organizations like Tattle Creek, and we honestly couldn't have survived for 25 years without those funds, so thank you. Thanks to Magazines Canada, our distributor and industry organization. Thanks to all our advertisers, who were very important to us along the way. Thanks to Tattle Creek's magazine friends, Broken Pencil, This, and the Feathertail Review. Thanks to anyone who supported us over the years, anyone who sponsored us, anyone who hosted us for one of our parties. We got to launch at some incredible venues over the years, and none more incredible than the Jet Fuel Coffee Shop here in Toronto, which was our summer home for 22 years. Thanks to Johnny Engler, the owner, for having us for so long and being so kind to us. Thanks as well to Steam Muscle Brewing, our beer sponsor for those same 22 years. Incredibly generous of them. Thanks to Chris Young and the gang at Prolific, especially Joel Ordonez, for printing the magazine so wonderfully for just a little over half its run. Tattle Creek had almost 400 contributors over the years. I can't name them all. I do want to thank them all. And I just want to run down a list of some of the ones that were especially, I guess, close to me and just were around a lot and offered a lot of friendship and support. Kind of above and beyond, not to belittle anyone I'm not going to mention, but very quickly, thanks to John Deegan, Chris Chambers, Derek McCormick, Emily Polary, Jim Monroe, Elise Friedman, Terry Murray, Alana Wolf, Emily Schultz, Alex Boyd, Alan Zvecki, Alex Moenick, Sarah Gilbert, Mike Christie, Julie Cameron Gray, Brian Francis, Sonia Allers, Evie Christie, Richard Kelly Kemick, Stacey Mayfowles, Jason Kiefer, Jennifer Lovegrove, Jacqueline Nelson, Joe Wolman, Patrick Raleigh, Clive Thompson, Doug Scott, Amy Stepaski, Adrian Weiss, Jessica Westhead, Stuart Ross, Mason Wright, and Lisa Whittington Hill. Have to thank the staff over the years quickly. Carrie Huffman founded the magazine with me in 1997. She was the original associate editor, and she tracked down a lot and just knew a lot of and introduced me to a lot of the original contributors of the magazine and kind of set the tone for the next quarter century. So thanks to Carrie. Rebecca Caldwell, our original copy editor slash proofreader. Aaron Hocko, our original photo editor. And Philip Smith, who came in and took over as photo editor after Aaron, but also pushed me to create a website and then proceeded to build that website and a e-newsletter. And he also came up with the idea to start having launches at the Jet Fuel Coffee Shop. And he came up with the idea for the free barbecue and to get Steam Whistle as a beer sponsor. So thanks to Phil. Thanks to Matthew McKinnon and John Piasecki, who took over the website in its later years. Our photographers, after Phil, Mark Lyle came on board for a while, and more recently, for half the magazine's run, Thomas Blanchard, who's done such an incredible job. Our illustrators, Ian Phillips was our original in-house illustrator and created the Tad mascot character with me. Matthew Daly took over for the second half of the run after Ian. Both did an incredible job. Hartley Lynn, who took over drawing Tad after Ian left. And Dave Lapp, our back page cartoonist. Thanks to John Montgomery, who does so many things behind the scenes that most people don't know about in terms of design and production. Our associate editors, of course, most recently Susanna Alyssa Andrew, before her Grace O'Connell, and between Grace and Carrie at the beginning was my good friend Andrew Daly. Thanks to Alfred Holden, our city building columnist, who's done so many great features for us over the years, and is just a good friend and a great supporter, and has done so much for the magazine over the years in so many ways. Kevin Connolly, our copy editor for the last 20 years, and Joyce Byrne, our proofreader, who's been around just one issue longer than Kevin even. and as a magazine dynamo. And last, I just personally want to thank some people. Tim Davin, Brett Popwell, Peter Jocelyn, Michael Thorner, Chris Chambers, Andrew Daly, John Montgomery, Alfred Holden, Catherine McKernan, Laura Tobias, Ken Tobias, Tony Tobias, Suzanne Isaacs, Adrian Dorn, and Sue Carter. And with that, we'll move into the final Tattle Creek launch, and we'll be starting off with Mr. Alex Boyd, who wrote the very first piece of fiction ever to appear in Tattle Creek.
Thank you. Thank you, Conan. 25 years is an incredible run, and it's really meant more than I can say for myself and for so many other writers to have a stylish home for different bits of writing over the years. I'm ruining a surprise here, but this is a journal where you can write a note of thanks to Conan and everyone behind Tattle Creek, so you're very welcome to do that. I'd like to read a few poems. The poem that's in Tattle Creek is called Dairy Milk. It's just about revisiting the convenience store I used to go to as a boy. On a metal shelf, 9 pods of bread in short, neat rows as though at the morgue, an aisle over from glue traps for mice. On pegs, round the corner, stuff for kids, dusty bags of balloons that seem to quietly cry out about missed birthdays, handcuffs and gun. Dairy Milk, a redundant name I see now, and with all the appeal of a boiler room. Hard to believe this bright, dusty place was my childhood corner store, packed with wanted things. This is where my dad said, "Why not? You're a good kid," and bought me 2 Superman comics, so that I was speechless a moment. I believe I said thanks. It was unlike a quiet man. My mother enjoyed the happiness of others the way you'd enjoy the warm glow of a fire. Gone now over 20 years as I sail slowly around corners here. The first few times someone dies or there's a sudden change, it's a few trees falling, but the woods are still there. To be older is to notice clear fields. Well, fine. Let this store be a boiler room powering me while I mule carry groceries for my children. Can a room sense what it becomes to someone else? As though on an assembly line, a room rolls down landscapes of purpose and finally off the map. Leaving the store, I bought a drink, asked about comics, but he laughed and said no more. I'm tempted to climb up on this and be like a magical pixie that reads poems. This one I just wrote after watching a whole bunch of old horror movies. This is called Bride of Frankenstein. These discs are the best use for technology. Forget sending businessmen to England in 4 hours. They'll just want to go in 3. Here's how it works. The disc spins, and for every little Boris, there's a little bride deep in the silver, somewhere under your reflection, the worry lines on your brow. They meet and spin, and the film starts to play. So what if Lon Chaney is a plump wolfman, or the body count just isn't all that high? In the days before quantity meant more, murdering a few people made you evil. So what if the Lugosi Dracula is staked off camera, heads turning? You don't need to see every bloody thing now, do you? Again, the villagers are back with torches, tearing down signs all over town. Assistant needed. Must be hunchback. Have 2 years experience pulling levers. Boris doesn't scare me. I'm taking him to stand there, right at the entrance, where the world pours thickly into my dreams. His instructions smash all the unhappiness. I'd like to read a poem by Fraser Sutherland. Fraser Sutherland passed away last year. This book was edited by him, and he was very generous about it. We sat around on patios throughout the summer, and he insisted on buying all the coffee, saying, "The writer doesn't pay, the writer doesn't pay." That sets a bad precedent. But he was a writer too. He was just insisting on buying all the coffee. I didn't know Fraser reviewed poetry books for the Globe for 30 years until I read it in his obituary, because he didn't boast about anything. Fraser had a son named Malcolm, and when Malcolm was 11, he wrote this poem, Malcolm, 11, almost home. Through the back gate in the yard, he halts, stands unmoving in the snow, nerves calmly stretched, like a hilltop fox, a hunting dog on point at the still center of an elsewhere world. What does he sniff edged on the cold? What far-off sound? The reek of prey? Nearing hoofbeats? Alert, he remains for poised minutes, and then whatever it is, whatever it was, he gives it up. He trudges to the house for lunch, leaving behind what happens next. And I'll just read one page from this novel I wrote that's... it's a retelling of the Odyssey, but the main character is falling through time. And so this is just the part where he ends up in Manhattan, in New York. I'd never been to Manhattan when I had my life, so it wasn't an unpleasant surprise to discover that's where I was, the third time I fell back a few years. Slightly dazed, the first thing I did was step out of the pedestrian lane on the Brooklyn Bridge so that a cyclist had to brake. I said sorry, but he just shook his head and rode on with me pegged. I went to the invisible scarf of smog on the observation deck of the Empire State Building, the fleets of hesitating cabs below, no bigger than yellow candy bars on a rack. New York is the Metropolitan Museum, the Museum of Modern Art, the Guggenheim, a saxophone player in Central Park, and a man kissing ketchup off his hand in Battery Park with a statue in the distance. The square in front of Rockefeller Center looked like the ring on a rich man's hand, and so much of Times Square asked for your attention that none of it got any. The people were fascinating contradictions. Parts of the city had the urgency of a cigarette on a bed, and yet three times, as I stood looking at a map, someone stopped to ask if I needed help. I watched a fit young businessman remove the top half of his suit and start a workout on a side street, and another man do contortions for spare change. A middle-aged man glanced at me and narrowed his eyes. As he walked by, he held up a cigarette in one hand and a bottle of Coke in the other, moving his lips from one to the other, both held a few inches from his face. So he goes to a cathedral where he meets a character named Carl and becomes friends with Carl. He asked if I was a priest because I happened to be standing calmly with my hands behind my back. He lost his wife and daughter in an accident that spit them out of the car side by side on the road like a couple of factory items. He did most of the talking, but it was nice to be near another human soul, and slowly he began letting me say things. I became his friend because I thought I could help him and because I didn't have any friends. I trusted his loyalty, felt he'd never hurt anyone, and he was good enough to give me a couch in his simple apartment. He read voraciously, but he seemed to file the books away in his memory without impact, like photographs in an album he had no intention of reopening. I found several odd jobs and settled into an apartment of my own. One evening, as we sat with coffee, he suddenly asked, "What was the first book that really grabbed your nuts?" I thought about it and replied something about Lord of the Flies in high school. Thank you, everybody. Don't forget to sign the book. Write a note. Thanks, Tony.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Alex. Now there's no traffic now that he's done. I apologize for the traffic. The back is closed. And it was here or really nothing. So,
it's perfect.
Good. Okay. Our next author is Alexandra Leggett. Alexandra is just a powerhouse reader. I still remember for our fourth issue, which is, I think the first one she was in for our launch at the Rivoli, it was her and Peter Derbyshire and Jason Anderson, and they did such an incredible reading. And she's always incredible when she reads, and I know she will be incredible tonight, too. She has an incredible, eclectic collection of books, fiction and poetry. Check them all out. Please welcome Alexandra Leggett.
Thank you, Conan. It's a thrill to be here. Conan is one of the few people that's actually been able to drag me out of the country. in the last little while. So thank you for that. And then my friend Mary, who drove me here because my car broke down and she was based there. So thank you also, Mary, for dragging me out of the country. I'm here, you know, with a happy heart and also a very sad one, because you've just been incredible for all of us. And you've created a community. You've created a family. And you've published some of us that maybe nobody else would have published before. So I'm a little bit worried about that as I go forward. So I wish you all the best with your future path. And good for you for making the decision to change. Because I know that's a hard one. So thank you. So before I get too sentimental, I'm going to read two short pieces this evening. God knows if you can hear me, but I will try my best to bellow the best I can. I'm going to go into my back catalog because I do believe, maybe it's the musician in me too, that, you know, the old records are just as good as the new ones. And why forget about where we started? I mean, I wish I could write like I did then, to be completely honest. So I'm going to read a poem, as Alex did. So great that we're going back to the poetry. And this is from my first book, This Is Me Since Yesterday, which is every day of my life till now and onwards. This is a poem I wrote about my brother, Graham, who is now my late brother. I always love to pay homage to him. And this is called, like you were writing about New York, I'm gonna write about San Francisco. So this is called Cropped Up in San Francisco. When I knew you last, your golden baby hair swayed like my breezy thoughts about you and the great life you were leading south of the border. Sun-kissed skins a far cry from the rice and bean curd complexion that stretched across your hairless head and slouching in front of me at our point of reunion. This is what Zen has done for you. Your California crazed up fantasies can only be cashed in LA, you say, and you lead me to your one-eyed girlfriend who's been baking bread since 5 a.m. and just informed you she's pregnant and happy about it. I play Pac-Man at the end of Hate Street and think about Seal Rock and Alcatraz eating jelly beans, one for each of life's little religions. You're somewhere else, on your knees, with your eyes closed. Thank you. Now we go to the scary stuff. This is brand new. I've been had a terrible writer's block, actually, for a long time, something that I'm almost scared to admit. But so be it, it happens. Thank goodness I realized it wasn't the end of things. It was just the beginning of new things. Just don't ever write another novel about Alexandra, I said to myself. And as Samuel Beckett, one of my favorite writers, said, fail, fail again, fail better. So I'm back to my faves, which are short stories. Woo-hoo! And thank you. So I don't know. This is why I don't want you to leave, Conan, because this story's been rejected by every journal I've sent to.
Fred will take it.
Yeah. All right, Fred. Well, let's see what you think. But I don't care. This is what readings are great for, right? You test things out, you get your responses, you learn from how you read it out loud, you learn from the passersby. So here I go. You don't have to tell me what you think. It's called Traces of You. When I settled into the old stone farmhouse, the landlord said the stone quarry rests by the original barn. I can use as many stones as I want to decorate the gardens, level out my rain barrels, anything, he said. Every day I walk my dog past the stones towards the ruins of the original barn. In a whoosh of my arm, I wish I could resurrect it all, bring the past back to life. I want to rescue donkeys and horses, raise pygmy goats, walk into my backyard and collect eggs from the chicken coop that I imagined there. It would take much more than a whoosh of my arms, and resurrecting the past is not advisable. Rescuing animals can be done. I'd need to make a lot more money and learn things I once knew, since forgotten, about caring for other things. A friend of mine advised me not to care so much about a horse I lease. It's not yours, she said. Another friend told me I need to let go of the things that friend says. I tried to suppress the original comment. I took a walk out back with my dog and sat on the remaining concrete walls of the barn. I replayed the conversation in my head and went over all the things I wish I had thought to say in the moment, like, he's more mine than yours. And now I've lost my place. I spoke about it to other people. Then those people probably spoke about it to other people. Sitting out there on the ruined wall of a once thriving barn, I felt I too had destroyed something I cannot get back. If loving something too much, if caring for a being too much, even though it isn't mine, is a bad thing, so be it. A rabbit runs by and the dog goes crazy. We get up and walk in the opposite direction. Across the soy field, a coyote runs towards a flock of geese and keeps going. Turkey vultures perch on the steel roof of the newer barn, the more complete barn, and gaze down at the dog. When she notices them, she'll go crazy. I believe that I didn't have her unleashed like I normally do. Then what? She'd be lured into the pack and destroyed. My one friend says I should be careful what I say to other people. I am neutral at the best of times. I don't want to speak ill of people. It crumbles walls, ruins once thriving structures. Trees grow out of the middle of the old silo. The dog stands on its edge. I feel she'll fall into the craggy hole that once housed a comfy bed of grain. She is more than steady on her feet. I climb up next to her, grab a spindly branch from a tree that's grown up through the gaping hole. I want to prove I too can be steady on my feet, that all this regret has not weakened my balance. I search through the stones. I need a wheelbarrow and another person to help me lift them. I think of which friend to ask. I think of the women down the road and the men they live with. I think of the difference between strength and will. I have the will. I do not have the physical strength to lift stones the size of foxes and larger. I don't want to live with a man who can lift things for me. I don't want to live with a man ever again. I wish I could clean out the mess within the ruins of the original barn. A friend said it would make an amazing patio area. She lifted her arms towards the sky and said, "Imagine fairy lights strung between those two stone walls. You'd have to cut down all the new trees that have sprung up there, though." "How would I do that?" I asked. She paused and said, "With a chainsaw." "I wouldn't want to harm the trees. I would like that patio. Imagine the other side," I said, "over there, by that rustic wooden door." She looked at me and said, "One step at a time, one step at a time." This is the same friend that told me not to care too much about a horse I miss. The house isn't mine either, nor the ruins of the old barn, or the rabbit, or the turkey vultures, or the coyote. The dog is mine. Thank God the dog is mine. I walk through the ruins and think about a time that I was someone's, when I was wed, owned. I think of the stone remnants that institution left behind, the crumbled marriage. I imagine trees growing up and through the empty shell of me, and traces of the husband wielding a chainsaw. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Alexandra. If anybody wants to fill in the space here, if you can't hear, feel free to come in closer, since nobody seems to have a problem being inside together. Jessica Westhead, I think, showed up in the slush pile for when I was looking for new writers for the 5th anniversary issue. And she's had an incredible career so far, and I love her writing so much, and I love her so much. And I'm glad she's here tonight to do some readings for us. Please welcome Jessica Westhead.
Thank you, Conan. I had to write down what I'm going to say, or I will just blabber on. So thank you to everyone for coming tonight. I am a big fan of Alex and Chris and Alexander's writing, so I'm delighted to be reading with them tonight. And I'm so thrilled to have a story in Tattle Creek number 50, but I am very sad it's the final issue. I've been thinking about all the great pre-COVID Tattle Creek launches, where we met in dark, crowded bars and didn't need to wear masks, and the amazing community, as Alexandra mentioned, that has grown out of these events. And Matthew Daly's awesome illustrations that I always look forward to. And Conan's brilliant editing and the care he always takes with literary fact-checking. I have had the honor of being in a bunch of issues now, and starting in 2002, so the 20 years of love that Conan has shown my writing means a lot to me, so much to me. So I'm going to try to project. I'm going to read a story from a new collection that will be published next fall by the wonderful folks at Invisible Publishing. It's about the obliviousness of white privilege and the harm that well-intentioned white ladies can do. So I'm taking the perspective of characters who are white, cis, straight, and mostly middle-aged and middle-class, like myself, and I'm exploring their poorly disguised entitlement and racism in an effort to ridicule and condemn that behavior and the problem of centering whiteness. But the elements of racism are still there, so I wanted to mention that up front. So this story follows a newly woke white woman who is flailing for connection with a black coworker. It's called Cheryl, Are You Okay? Cheryl, I am feeling this enormous pressure. that is filling me up inside. Cheryl, this feeling does not feel good. It's something new, and it's been building inside me, and before I felt it, I felt nothing at all. There was only harmony. Now it's all disharmony. Cheryl, I saw you out walking the other day at lunch, and I waved to you, but I think you didn't see me. I wanted to tell you something that day, but I wasn't quite sure how to articulate it. But now I think I can. This pressure keeps building, and it's like, do you know when you have to let something out, but it's stuck really deep inside? And you start to become afraid it might never come out. And it will be stuck inside you, creating that unbearable feeling of pressure forever? I would compare it to giving birth, maybe. But I had a C-section. I did try pushing for a while, but Olivia wasn't coming out of me that way. So eventually they said, sorry, Bethann, we have to do it another way. Which, to be honest, was fine, because I was always terrified of getting ripped open at the end. Cheryl, please help me remove this unbearable feeling. Cheryl, do you know how I figured out about lived experience? It was way back at the start of Me Too, and I was trying to explain to my husband how it feels to be a woman who finds herself alone somewhere with a strange man, in a taxi, in an elevator, a parking garage, or any number of endless similar situations that we're all familiar with. And he could not even come close to comprehending what that fear feels like. Although I could see him trying, and I appreciated that. I am trying, Cheryl, but I know my limits, which is why I'm asking you to explain it to me, like I explained it to my husband. And that conversation brought us closer because it was like suddenly a light went on for him. And after that, he did more dishes without even being asked. It has only recently occurred to me how little I know and understand. And you know so much. Remember last summer when I invited you to my cottage, but you were unavailable? I was going to ask for your advice then, but I couldn't. Cheryl, I am wondering if you saw the petitions I have been posting on my Facebook page. I have been posting a lot of petitions lately. I also like to include a comment to increase the likelihood that people will sign them. Cheryl, I didn't grow up with any of this stuff. My parents are good people, but they were raised not to talk about things. And then, as a result, so was I. Also, I never really knew anyone else who isn't like me because I have always been surrounded by people like me. So when I met you, I was so happy. I'm serious, Cheryl. I am not making this up. The street I grew up on, my elementary school, no, but there was one Asian boy in my grade 2 class. I am not sure if Asian is the correct term to use anymore. I overheard you and Tamara talking last week about how you found it annoying that Asian is a food group at the supermarket. And I sort of understand why you would be annoyed at that, but then no, I don't understand at all. Also, my high school and my university and all the part-time jobs I ever had. Also, my post-university trip to Europe. And then my post-European trip, carefree party days in my 20s when I moved out of my parents' house in the suburbs and found a little apartment in the city thanks to an ad in the weekly paper. Yikes, that makes me sound old. So you'd think I'd be wiser by now, haha, but Cheryl, I'm not. And then I met my husband, and he was like me, and all his friends were also like us. And then I got my job, and before you and Tamara started, everyone was the same there too. Okay, wait, I guess if I truly stop and think about it, there were maybe some people in the background, in some stores, in some restaurants, but in the library and on public transit mostly. And then my husband and I bought our house and we had our daughter, and now she goes to a school where most of the kids and most of the parents are like us. So the same pattern is beginning all over again. It just goes on and on. Cheryl, I miss when you used to talk to me. when I would pass by your desk and we would say hello and maybe laugh at a funny internet meme. For a while, I thought we were becoming friends. I told my husband about you. But then you stopped talking to me, and I don't know why. Cheryl, I did an interesting thing once. Way before you started working there, a perception expert came to the office and did a workshop with all the employees because management was unhappy with our creativity ratios. The goal for us was to become aware of how narrow our scope of awareness was by doing an exercise that would encourage us all to widen our lenses. The expert told us some things and then sent us outside for our lunch break. And as we left the conference room, she handed each of us a folded up piece of paper. "This is your color," she said. "Hold on to it. Do not unfold this piece of paper until you get outside. Make sure you're alone when you read the word. Then close your eyes and open them again." So I took my folded up piece of paper outside and I went to my favorite spot behind the building that I haven't shown you yet. Or maybe you already know about it. There is a bench that is always empty next to a planter that used to have flowers in it, but then the flowers died and nobody replaced them. So there is only dirt inside the planter now. I like to sit on that bench by myself and eat lunch. And when I'm done eating, I like to put my hands into that cool soil and pretend that my fingers are the long, grasping roots of plants. I know that's bizarre. It's just a thing I like to do. It makes me feel better. The day of the workshop, I sat on the bench and I was so eager to unfold my paper that I ripped it a little. And then I was sitting there as still as a statue with nobody else around, and I was silently looking at my word that seemed to pulsate on the page. Blue. Then I closed my eyes as we had been instructed, and then I opened them again. And Cheryl, the effect was instantaneous. It was like a magic trick. All of a sudden, all of the other colors disappeared and blue was all I could see. There was nothing else. My gaze jumped from one blue thing to another, a recycling bin, the faded lettering on the wall behind me, a bird, a plastic bag caught in a tree, my pants, and my goodness, the sky. Cheryl, I have never experienced anything quite like that before, and I don't think I ever will again. The feeling of being surrounded and overwhelmed by all of that blue, it was life-changing. And I think it's connected to this discussion in some way, but I have no idea how. So I was hoping you might have some insight you could offer. Cheryl, are you okay? I saw that thing on the news. It was horrible. I thought of you right away. I'm still thinking of you. I can't imagine. It's awful, Cheryl. My heart goes out to you. My heart is reaching for your heart across a vast, immeasurable distance. I hope that the darkness does not extinguish your light. I hope you are still finding joy. I am hopeful that if we combine our light, then there will be no more terrible things. Those awful things are in the news too much, and the other day I overheard you telling Tamara you were sad. And I know I can't feel your pain as if it's my own, but I am trying to. Just tell me what to do. Tell me how I can help. Help me out, Cheryl. I see you. I hear you. I'm with you. I stand by you. I don't know what else to do. I wore the safety pin, and then I took it off when my cousin posted something about the safety pin not being helpful. Actually, it might be co-opted by people with bad intentions instead of good ones. Cheryl, I put up the black square. I'm not sure if you saw it. I put it up on that day we were supposed to, and then I left it up for a few days longer before I read a post from my cousin saying the black square was not helpful. Although she didn't say why, but in any case, I took it down immediately. And I know there are more things I could be doing, but I don't know what those things are. Cheryl, I am aware I get an overly wide and unnatural smile whenever I encounter certain people in public places. Cheryl, I don't know how to not do that smile. I'm trying, but it just popped onto my face. Cheryl, I can tell you are suffering, and I don't want to minimize that. I can tell there is something going on with you, and I feel so far away from you, Cheryl, but I don't want to be so far away. You are over there, and I'm over here, and the other day when I saw you out walking at lunch, I thought about trying to catch up to you and asking how you were doing, but you were walking so fast, I couldn't. I admire you, Cheryl. You are beautiful and strong, and Tamara is beautiful and strong. I have so much admiration for both of you. I want you to know that, but I don't know how to say it in a way that doesn't sound weird. Cheryl, I am not okay. But I am starting to realize that maybe there are different levels of not being okay that do not apply equally to all of us. Cheryl, maybe I shouldn't send you this letter. Maybe I'll just hold on to it for now. Thank you.
Well, nobody follows the killer, so there's nobody I would rather have close things off than Mr. Chris Chambers. Very wary of picking favorites, but I don't think anybody will be surprised if I say that Chris Chambers is my favorite poet. I love reading his poetry, and I love listening to him read more than anything. He has, as of this issue, he just narrowly beat out Stuart Ross as the person with the most contributions in Title III. 20 pieces in 50 issues. Sorry, Stu. I love Stuart Ross, too. Chris is just an incredible poet, incredible reader, and a great friend, and I'm so glad he's here tonight. So please welcome Chris Chambers.
Okay, thanks, everybody. Thanks, Conan. I'm sure I can see what I'm doing here. So,
can you see?
The outdoor reading when the sun gone down. Yeah, I love it. Love it. It's my new style.
Do you want a bike light?
I can do better than that, baby.
Right.
I'm going to go this route. Conan's been so good to me for so long, and so he's likes my poems almost more than my father likes them, and it's great. I just thought I'd thanks. You know, I just was riding my bike over here and thinking about all the things we were doing 25 years ago, going to aunties and uncles for brunch and this kind of small press book fair in Trinity Church, and so many cool things, and so great to be here. I think I get this on upside down. It's my daughter's from camp. There we go. We'll figure it out. I just have two short poems. They're both new. One is also about a convenience store, like Alex's poem from the book. I'm not sure what it was about convenience store poetry that got you this time, Conan. I did want to briefly tell a story about the one that got away. Paddle Creek published a children's special issue a few years back, and I didn't even know that Conan was aware of children, to be honest. But when he told me that, and I had a kid and was writing nothing but children's poems, but so I pulled one out of my back pocket and I gave it to him, and I didn't see him for months after that. And when I did bump into him after that, I said, how's the children's issue going? He said, it went to press yesterday. And I said, is there a Chambers poem in it? He said, just to cover the kids' ears, the poem had the word fuck in it. And I said, well, it was at the end of the poem. It's like, no, nobody reads to the end of the poem. But anyways, so it didn't, I didn't get into the children's poem. I do have an outdoor poem I'd like to start with. It's new as well, and I'm nerve-wracked about it, as never read it before. Oh, yeah, that'll work. One of my better looks, I'm sure. Sirens. I'm going to shout it. Sometimes a siren is a faraway bandsaw. Sometimes a screaming baby. Sometimes a siren is a runaway box that comes with a pair of medics. Sometimes a siren is a clamoring hook and ladder heaving downtown around corners. Sometimes a siren's a calling to arms. Sometimes a call to hide underground. Sometimes a siren, indeed, the most famous of them all, is a trick, a sort of beautiful trap. Sometimes a siren's just a bird, singing like a faraway bandsaw, or like a screaming baby. Sometimes a siren is a bird copying a cop car. Sometimes a siren, late at night, on TV, portends a murder. And if the show is a certain vintage of smoke. Sometimes a TV siren punctuates the 11 o'clock news and all the evening's programs leading in. Sometimes a sparkly lit siren on a late summer night sings at the edge of the star-glinting lake. Sometimes a siren sings like Casey Musgraves. Sometimes Bob Dylan. Thank you. Also want to thank Conan and Tattle Creek for putting me together with the great illustrator and creator Ian Phillips, who has a fantastic illustration on this that goes with the poem in the 50th and final Tattle Creek, which might mark my retirement as well. Check it out. Ian kindly sent a long list of all the references to the poem that are in the illustration. So, it's about next act. Mine, sort of, but everyone's in a way. It's called Jane Jacobs Variety. Next act, a small convenience store like Joy Cigar, with a big pine magazine rack and a few smart regulars to live it out with. Maybe a single barber chair in a small back room, and an old Greek barber who keeps hours Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturday mornings. Or some young guy with a neat trimmed beard. I wouldn't mind, after all the old Greek barbers have retired. I'll keep up relations with my magazine connections, Leanne, of course, at Distacor, and Steve from Metro News with the wax-tipped mustache, and Yvonne, who might be retired or long gone, of course. Things change. We get older, sure, but people still need psychology today. Pack of white zigzags, the lucky eight ball scratchy, no? We carry vellum and poetry, ARC, CV2, Poetry's Dead, all the greatest journals. And the local writers would come in to visit, some blithely followed by off-leash dogs eating baths. Every February, our bookkeeper would wonder why we had such a good week just after the PLR checks hit the street. Our flash sign, designed by a local with an Etsy shop, would dazzle and pop, Jane Jacobs Variety. Or Tattle Creek One Stop. And we could mock up a subway map with the Tattle Creek One Stop marked slyly onto it until some sticky TTC official spots it, flashes badge, and makes us pull it down. Owning the building would be real helpful, but in the business plan, we only crowdfund the first $5 million. After this poem gets out for a piece of this action, the venture capitalists will line up with their checkbooks out front. Thank you. Thanks so much, guys. Beautiful.
Thank you. Good night, and thank you.